Welcome to Blondie and the Brit, Writing, Publishing, and Beyond. You can find our show notes and more information about our podcast at blondieandbrit.com. That's BLONDIEANDBRIT.com. Welcome to Blondie and the Brit podcast. I am Blondie, KJ Waters.
And I'm Suzanne Cowman, I'm the Brit.
And together we're Blondie and the Brit.
Yay!
Woohoo! I am the author of Stealing Time.
And I'm the author of The Rejected Writer's Book Club.
Welcome to Blondie and the Brit. Today we have Ian McKenzie, all the way from South Africa. Ian grew up in Johannesburg and served with the Rhodesian military during the Bush War from 1976 to 1980. His first novel, Clouds in the Wind, has over 70 nearly five-star reviews and was inspired by his time in the military. Welcome to the program, Ian.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me. It's an absolute privilege, and I love it. This business is talking to people across the ocean.
Yes. Well, we're very excited, too. You're our very first South African on the show, so we're kind of a big fan of your accent, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I feel quite privileged.
It's pretty cool, man. All right. So speaking of South Africa, is there a challenge or different challenges that maybe you face when you're trying to reach a European or U.S. audience from your location?
I think there is, you know. South Africa, although it's a fairly advanced country economically, or has been, it's kind of in the backwaters. So the British market, the American market, are very, very difficult markets to reach from where we are. We're sort of down the southern tip of Africa. And there are a lot of misconceptions about Africa, particularly South Africa. And I think that throws out challenges of its own. Trying to break into a market like the American or the British market, really, really does have its challenges.
And also, you know, the physicality, if you're trying to mail a book or, you know, set up an interview, you've got a big time difference. There's some physical issues as well. Yeah. All right. So tell us about your story and kind of the inspiration behind it, your Clouds in the Wind.
Well, the story is, Andrew Mason is a financial executive. He comes from a very good family, a very good school, and he suffers a tragedy, which I'm not going to tell anybody about because it's in the book.
Right.
He suffers a tragedy during a visit to Rhodesia, and it makes him very bitter and angry. And he goes to Rhodesia and joins the army. And from that point, it follows the way of life as it existed in Rhodesia during that conflict. The way the farmers steadfastly refused to leave their land and continue to farm. And instead of what was happening, what the British government intended to do to Rhodesia, they said they'd bring Rhodesia to its knees within 6 months. Well, 15 years later, they're still standing up very strong because
goodness. The
resilience of the Rhodesian people was just such they just refused to give up. And eventually what happened was that the economics of the program simply was not sustainable. South Africa was becoming threatened by the international community in terms of oil supplies, and South Africa was the only ally that Rhodesia really had. And once South Africa was forced into a position where they said, listen, you're going to have to capitulate, the whole thing collapsed. It collapsed on an economic basis rather than... But now, the way in which the hero in the book is Andrew Mason, and his life is all... You know, what happens to him is almost symbolic of what happened to Rhodesia, because very, very successful, broken down by unjust means, got up and started to fight, and then basically, as time went on, so it became less and less and less possible to continue the fight because resources were very limited and so on. And I think if one looks at Andrew Mason's life during this book, it almost symbolizes what happened to Rhodesia.
Yeah.
Although I've got to confess that I only picked that up after I finished writing the book.
Oh, so that was a subconscious thing in there. That's really neat.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
All right, so tell me, you come up with the story, you write the book, and then you put it out into the world, and tell us about your experience.
Yeah. Being a first-time author, my entire career after I left the military in Rhodesia, I came back to South Africa, and my career was based on finance and administration. And I ran my own business, and in 2009, it started to look as though I could see the writing on the wall, certain things were going wrong in the business. So I'd had this book in the back of my mind for years and years and years, and I sat down and I started to write it. And because of the work pressures and things like that, I sort of wrote over weekends and in evenings, and every now and again I get a bit of a spurt of enthusiasm and write.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I got it finished in 2013. by which time I closed my business. And not knowing anything about the publishing industry at all, I started to send my manuscript out to publishers. And I continued to basically either be ignored or sort of just told them. If I waited for a year or two, they'd get around to reading it. Then I came across a crowd on the internet, and I don't know whether I should mention their names. Would that be unethical?
I think you should.
Okay. There's a crowd called Author Solutions, and Author Solutions are the umbrella company for about 8 different small publishing companies, which I refer to as Vanity Press. And it's Author House, Ex Libris, iUniverse, Partridge. Author Solutions fits in there as well, although they're the umbrella company. It's Hay House, and this whole lot is actually owned by Penguin, although Penguin have subsequently sold out their share in this. But what these people do is you send them a manuscript, they back you within 5 days, which is terribly impressive, and they say, we have read this book, and my golly, do we want to publish it. This is the stuff that we really enjoy. And of course, you know, the author who sent the stuff to them, and in this particular case, me, thinks, well, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, that's exactly what you want to hear.
And they're recognized by talent, which of course, you know, everybody sees they've got talent. You know, it's wonderful stuff. And what does one want? And they say, well, now, this is how we work it. We are going to charge you, and it's a very small amount of money. It's £500, which is they charge you in British money, which is £500 is about $800 or thereabouts. And then this is what we'll do, and we will produce a book and so on. So all you've got to do is sign this little agreement and then send us money, and everything's good. And that's what they do. And up until that point, they are extremely efficient. They're brilliant. So what they do is you send them a manuscript, and within about 2 weeks, they send you back a book.
Wow.
It's properly laid out, because the interior is laid out nicely, the ISBN has been registered, the ASIN has been registered, it's on the internet, it's not on the internet as yet, because they send it back to you to proofread what obviously I had to edit the book, which I had the book edited by a professional prior to this, so it was a bit on my side. So the book is edited, then they send it back to look for mistakes that they might have made in the printing or publishing process. So you read the book again, you send it back, sign it off and say everything is great. No sooner is the ink dry on the first copy than the marketing department is onto you, and they say, we have read this book, and my golly, has this book blown us away. We are breathless with excitement over this whole book. What you don't realize at that point in time is they're telling everybody the same thing, and nobody's read a word of the book. It's just the psychological marketing that they do. And it's a wonderful book, and you are going to go so far, you will be a household name. Believe me, this is the most... But... You know, if nobody knows that the book is there, nobody's going to buy it. So what we're going to do for you now, and this is amazing, because we can give you such a good deal on the marketing of this book, it'll blow it away. And at that point in time, you know, I knew that the enthusiasm that they were showing started to sound very, very plastic. And it sounded like they were trying to stroke my ego. And fortunately, I'm a little bit more mature than needed my ego to be stroked. So I started to question them. And I questioned them with a whole lot of things. And I said, look, your compliments are a little bit over the top. I know you mean well, but quite honestly, I think it sounds too good to be true. And usually if something sounds too good to be true, it usually is. So at this point in time, let's get back to basics and let's be genuine and ground ourselves on it. Well, all right, we were telling you exactly what we told you before. We were blown away. But, okay, here's our marketing package. And then they offer you this package, which sounds absolutely stunning, because what they're doing now is they're introducing you to the international press, television, radio, prints, newspapers. New York Times will get a copy. Everybody's going to hear all about this book. And we will give you a website, and we will give you a YouTube video on this book, and we'll create this whole lot, and we'll give you a whole lot of bookmarkers and business cards and things like that. And this is going to be the way we're going to market this book. And it sounds wonderful. And I said, right, give it to me in writing. Send me all what you've told me in writing, which they do.
Right.
And eventually I thought, why not? You know, it sounds so good. These guys really know what they're doing. Let's go for it. And that's to charge you £2,700, which converting that into South African money is 52,000 rand, as it was at that time. It'll be a lot more now because our currency is devalued. But at that point in time, 52,000 rand in South Africa is a lot of money. You know, you can do an awful lot of things with 52,000 rand. Anyway, I went ahead and I paid it. And the very next day, I get a call from the sales department. And the sales department guy says, Ian, we've got this, and marketing is going out, but you're going to need books. We don't publish books. You've got to actually pay for the books to be published. But we've got to get these books onto the shelves because this marketing is going to go out, and it's a wonderful, wonderful concept, and everything's going to work, but we've got to work it like clockwork. We need to have books on the shelves. And if we don't have books on the shelves, you're going to waste your money on the marketing. So I said, well, how many books do you think we should have? He said, well, I think we should start out with 3,000 because that's the most economical number that you can get. And if you start with 3,000, we can do about £1.95 per book. And I did the calculation, it was about 32 Rand. So 32 Rand times 3,000, I'm looking, and that's 100 and something odd thousand Rand. And I'm thinking, that makes it 150, 700. But these guys are so enthusiastic and so good at what they did that I really, even with all my years of experience and my age and all that, it sounded wonderful. And they gave it all to me in writing as well. So I said, okay, go for it. In this stage of the game, I've now spent 160 odd thousand Rand on the book. No sooner had the money left my account that everything went into silent mode. Took me from that, they sent me the marketing, what they'd done on the marketing, on an obscure email. And it turned out that the marketing to the introduction to the international press was a single email to 750 recipients. And each one of those recipients was a media house of one sort or another. One email. And that was my introduction to the international press.
What about the press releases and the bookmarks and all those other things they promised? Did they ever deliver on any of those things?
The bookmarks were delivered to me 2 months later, which were useless anyway because, I still got them here.
Yeah.
I started looking for the books. And the guy, this chap, Monty Williams, who's the guy that I spoke to, he was the chap who gave me stuff. When I tried to get back to him, he was nowhere to be found. He was gone.
Oh, my gosh. It's like the bait and switch, the classic thing. They know, it sounds like they've really done a lot of research, like you said, on what a new author needs to hear and how to kind of build on that. And then they add a layer and they add a layer and add a layer. And it's really crooked. I feel like that it's a really good thing for people to hear. I mean, first of all, that an intelligent, good writer like you that has, kind of fallen victim to this. But I can't even tell you how many people I've talked to either on social media or in my personal life that are authors that have been pulled in by these smaller presses that do things like this. And if somebody asks you for money to publish their book, you better stop and think really hard about, is this a scam? Because most of the ones that are asking you for money do not have your best interest. If they can make money off your book, they're not going to ask the author for money. They're going to sell it and market it and do all the things that this company was supposed to do. Suzanne, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, I just agree with you, KJ. I mean, even the small presses, there's companies like BookTrove we talked about before, they take a percentage of the royalty, which is completely different because they're going to work to promote that book.
Right.
And you pay, instead of having to pay up front for editors and book cover people and all that kind of thing, you've actually got somebody who's in partnership with you selling that book. And that's different because you're not laying any money out.
Right.
You're just basically allowing them to have part of that payment. And if that's the only way that you can publish, then of course that makes sense to do that. But that's a hole that you're not putting any money at. I mean, but you are in a sense. So I think that you're right, Cage. At the minute somebody starts asking you for money, that the red flag should go up. Because the reality is, why couldn't you go and do that yourself? Why would they have to do that for you,
Exactly. I have a couple friends that I've talked to around here, and one of them was the same thing. They did very similar. They did a book cover that was horrible, and they didn't spend much time on it, and they got everything wrong. And then they also gave her, you have this great deal to buy your own books, and it's, X percent off, and they were supposed to be helping her sell the books. Why does the author need to buy a whole bunch of books,
Yeah, Ian, can I ask you a question? Did your books ever go anywhere? I mean, did they actually ever do anything with your books at all?
Well, eventually, they gave me back 50% of my marketing package. They paid that back to me because I eventually got a hold of it. Because, you see, they've got gatekeepers in all their phones. So when you phone the numbers, you want to speak to so-and-so, and, okay, I need to know who's calling because I need to be able to register. And, of course, then everybody who doesn't want to speak to you disappears.
Oh.
And I eventually got a hold of a guy named Alan Bauer, who, my understanding was, he's the sort of chief in charge of the main operations. And he put me on to a guy by the name of Hopkins. Between them, I eventually said to them, right, and once again, this is another mistake. I should have told them to give me back my money, but I figured I would never get that back because they were on the other side of the ocean. They knew I couldn't sue them for the money. They knew that they'd done wrong because that's how they make their money.
Yeah.
They knew I couldn't sue them, and or even if I could, I wouldn't, because it would be an enormously expensive exercise for me to start taking legal proceedings to America from South Africa.
Yeah.
And I said it would have been out of my price range. And they know that. So they're playing on that fact as well. But what they did eventually do is I said to them, right, send the books to me. Which, in hindsight, was a bad mistake. But, I kept on making these mistakes, and I've learned them by them as I've gone along. So at their cost, they sent the books to me, which I now have here in South Africa. And our rand has deteriorated to the extent over the last 6 months, or the last year anyway. It's lost about 50% of its value.
Oh, wow.
So now what I'm doing is I'm trying to get people in America. I have a guy by the name of Michael Castor in America who I'm... He's putting out feelers to see if somebody won't take these books in bulk at a hugely cut price. But with a dollar rand rate of exchange, I might still make my money back. But, you know, so the plan is to get them into America dead cheap for the Americans, but it'll still be able, because of the currency valuations that we've had here, or devaluations, it'll still bring me back the amount that I laid out on it, which I still lose on anyway, but it's far better doing it that way. Because to sell 3,000 books in South Africa, I subsequently discovered, is going bestseller route. I mean, you know, 3,000 books of one particular title.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen often that you get that number of books up.
Well, and you have to have a distribution channel. You're a guy in South Africa. You're not a bookstore. You don't have a huge bunch of places that you can put the book into. It's not something that you're hooked up with. So, you know, anyone, even someone in the United States, to have 3,000 books in their garage, what do you do with it? You're not going to sell that many at a book signing. Yeah. You know, that's like years and years worth of it, unless you have a distribution channel, so.
Yeah, well, that's obviously it, you know, because the distributor, and what I'm actually trying to do is to try and find a distributor in the States who has exactly that channel.
Yeah.
Because, you know, 3,000 books, I think, would probably get sold out into the American market, whereas in the South African market, it's not that easy. Now, we've got our big book stores. We don't have anything like Barnes & Noble or Wordsworth or anything like that. Yeah, we've got Exclusive Books, which is the biggest. But they are also extremely close shop. They don't like indie authors for reasons best known as themselves. And they will only normally deal with publishers and distribution agents who are publisher representatives.
Right.
So it becomes a hard call.
Yeah, and I think that's somewhat typical.
Okay, let's move on a little bit from that, Ian, because I think that's really good advice for our audience. I think the key is if somebody asks you for money, then really take a stop and a listen. Is that the right decision for you? Moving back to you and just kind of what you could want to get back to other things too. What is your writing process, Ian? How do you write? Do you write in the morning? Do you write at night? What do you do for writing?
Well, right at the moment, I find that, you know, I have a lot of time in my hands. So I write when I have the inspiration. With all the problem that I've had with Clouds in the Wind in terms of trying to sort of consolidate everything, I ran into a bit of an inspiration vacuum. But over the last couple of weeks, I've been pulling it out and going through it and started to reread what I've written for the sequel. And I've probably written about 150 pages so far. Mm-hmm. And I generally write when I get the urge to do so. And that could be in the middle of the night. Might be early in the morning.
Yeah.
But I'll be sitting there and I'll be thinking about something. And I think, that's it. I've got to write that down. And instead of rushing off to go and write it down, I go and turn on my computer and just start writing what I'm thinking. And I can polish that later, and which I do, and then I shift it up and put it into where it belongs. But, you know, that's generally the way it goes, and that's my style. I don't sit down specifically for a period of time. There's not, well, there's a saying which I think I might have created. I'm not sure. I've never heard anybody else use it. You cannot write from the head. You've got to write from the heart.
Right.
And if you're writing from the heart, your feeling is going into what you're actually writing. If you're writing from the head, your thoughts are going into it. And it's just a totally different feel. And I can feel when I'm on a roll, because I'm rolling and the story's writing itself. And I can feel it, and I can feel that emotion. I can feel, you know, the excitement of it, and I can put it down into pages, and that's what I do. When I'm thinking about it, it's kind of different. So I, as I say, write when I have inspiration. I don't set myself a specific time during the day to do it.
Well, yeah, that's great. Well, writing from the heart, I love that. So what? Tell us a little bit about the book that you're working on right now, The Sequel to Clouds in the Wind.
Right. With the demise of Rhodesia, when it became Zimbabwe, there was an exodus from Rhodesia, what had been Rhodesia. There were rumors of hit squads going out from the new government, none of which actually turned out to be true. It was all a pack of rumors and rumor mongering and panic stricken people generally just trying to sort of stir up a bit of panic. So there was no truth in it, and things actually worked out quite well. But the exodus from Rhodesia was quite large, because people scattered all over the world. They went to Australia, they came here to South Africa, they went to America, went to England, went to Europe. But there was the vast majority of the white population actually left Rhodesia. Now, Andrew Mason leaves Rhodesia, and there are things that happen in the book, in Clouds in the Wind, which I don't want to disclose, but it leaves him at a point where he's practically an alcoholic. He's broken, he's war-weary, but he's got a lot of money. But he decides he doesn't want to, and this happens at the end of Clouds in the Wind, where he actually goes for a job interview. And certain things from way back, which are in the book, from way back when, come back. And one of the reasons why he had gone to Rhodesia in the first place, come back to haunt him. And he realizes that he's been screwed over by his former employers. And he decides he needs to try and fix that. But he's not in a position to do so because he's wrecked. I mean, he's drinking far too much. He's got issues. So he discovers that there's a pending prosecution against him. So he packs his togs and he pulls out and he goes and he lives in the bush in the northern Transvaal area near Palabora, which is right on the border of our Kruger National Park. You might never have heard of it, but it's a wildlife sanctuary. You've got all form of African game. It just roam freely. It's a beautiful place. It really is.
Wow.
Absolutely amazing. And it's got lovely scenery, there's waterfalls. Anyway, he goes up into that neck of the woods and goes and he finds himself a cabin which he renovates. But all of a sudden, and this is all in the prologue to the book, which is about 3 pages. And all it really does is bring the reader who hasn't read Clouds in the Wind, or somebody has read Clouds in the Wind, just refreshing the memory. And so the prologue is there really just to sort of fill in the gaps. And he then goes to confront this banking institution who had done him down and who are now trying to prosecute him. He goes to confront them. And the people who, the top brass, it turns out, are politically motivated and politically motivated against the aspirations of the South African government. In other words, they are in support of the... Because by this time, bear in mind, early 1980s, South Africa was facing a very similar problem to what Rhodesia had been facing for the previous 15 years, because they had an enormously powerful military machine. They were faced with economic problems that were being created as a result of their failure to acknowledge that equal rights and democracy should come to South Africa. South African government, the Nationalist Party government, which are predominantly Afrikaans, were very, very Afrikaans-orientated. And they had, I mean, you've obviously heard the term apartheid, which needs a lot of explanation for people who have only heard the word and given a connotation. But effectively what it is total segregation of the races. And then that was frowned upon by the international community. And so Andrew Mason comes back into South Africa and he's confronted with this stuff, but now he's confronted with these bankers who have got a lot of money, a lot of power, but they've also got a lot of thugs working for them. And they try and take Andrew out. And he decides he needs to find out what is so important about all this. And he then starts to investigate or getting behind the scenes and find, and he discovers the cell of terrorism which is being created by what, you know, the African National Congress, who today are our government, but in those days were considered a terrorist organization and the enemy.
Oh, wow.
And so he gets, and it just becomes quite messy. Now, I'm in a situation at the moment where he's discovered their trade routes and what they're doing. They recruit, they've got a recruiting station, they've got an arms smuggling operation, they've got a drug smuggling operation. And this whole thing goes hand in glove. And it's all worked in through Mozambique, which is basically border South Africa. And everything is going. And so they've got this cashew nut farm, which is a conduit for all this activity that's going off into Mozambique, which has subsequently been spread out into Mkhonto Sizwe, which was the African National Congress's military wing. And so, you know, it sticks with a sort of soldier thing, but he is at the same time starting to see that this whole race thing was wrong. And everything he fought for was wrong. Because essentially, it is. So he's starting to see this. Once again, he gets himself into a huge psychological mix-up, and he is now going to try and unravel all this. And so one never knows who the good guys or who the bad guys are in this whole thing. And that will obviously pan itself out as time goes by.
That sounds like a really interesting story.
And a real development of the character, which sounds really fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you see this as a longer series or just the two books, or what is your vision?
I think I'm going to stick to the two books. In fact, although Clouds in the Wind, I've been able to draw on personal experience. A lot of what is in Clouds in the Wind actually happened. I'm not exactly where I've written it, but I've made it sound terribly romantic and terribly sort of exciting. But a lot of what is in Clouds in the Wind are real events. A big part of the book is actually real events. People have said to me, this is non-fiction. And I've said, no, it's fiction. It is fiction. And the story itself is fiction, but everything in that story actually happened at one point in time or another. Now, I ran into a sequel, into things which didn't happen. And I've got to now start creating what happened.
Ah, right.
And I think it was a mistake taking it beyond the first book because I left the end of Clouds of the Wind open specifically for a sequel. And that is another mistake that I made in doing this. But now that I've done that, I can't leave it. So I've got to carry it on. And once I'm finished with them, and I haven't quite decided what I'm going to call this book. I thought of Into the Storm, which is good fit, but I'm going to need to sort of seek out a bit of advice on that and let a couple of people read the manuscript. Then they can decide, and I'll take a vote and see who comes up with the best idea.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So at this point in time, we don't even know what the book's going to be called, but it's just going to be exciting.
That's nice.
Then that'll be closed off. And then I've got a lot of ideas for other books, which are possibly not quite as adventurous, but at the same time, you know, I haven't given a lot of thought to how my later books might pan out.
Well, that's exciting. It's good you have a lot of things in the works, though.
I'd like to write 5 books, and I'd like to do that over the next 5 years.
Good. Good luck.
Yeah. I think we're ready for our lightning round, aren't we, KJ?
Yes, that'll work.
How do you feel about lightning round, Ian? Do you know what that is?
Oh, yeah, go for it. Yeah, go.
Do you want me to do it, KJ?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so we're going to ask you 10 questions, Ian. And the idea of the lightning round is you just give short answers, just quick short answers, and then we move on and we just learn new things about you. So, okay. Are you ready?
Definitely.
What is your favorite band or artist?
Ever.
Oh, that's cool.
Wow, you go. That was when I was young, that they were around. Okay, this is an interesting one. So do we do South Africa or do we do America? Do you like the East Coast or the West Coast?
Well, in South Africa, I go South Coast because the East Coast and West Coast are in different countries. So, you know, we're always in the South Coast.
I was going to say that doesn't work in South Africa.
Okay. What is your favorite writing spot?
My favorite writing spot? Well, the only spot I've ever written in is at my desk in my study. That's where I sit and this is where and that's where I write. I suppose when you talk about that, you talk about writing. I could be writing anywhere, but I'm writing in my head, not physically bashing up on a keyboard.
It's a hammer.
Totally. So are you a pantser or a plotter? Do you know what that means, Ian? That's kind of an American expression. Pantser or a plotter?
I would say I was a pantser.
Oh, yeah, good. You know what it means. Good. Okay. If you could be transported back in time, where would you go?
I think I'd go back to the 1890s, back into Southern Africa, into the time of the migration north. I think that must have been enormously exciting.
Oh, cool.
Wow, you could do some research for your books. That'd be great. Okay, so if you had a superpower, what would it be?
I think it would be to read other people's minds. Does that count?
Absolutely. That's a good one.
Yeah, okay. Who or what inspires you?
Life inspires me. Now, there's so much that goes on around you all the time. You can't ignore it. Life goes on and life is exciting. Life inspires me.
Oh, I love that.
That's good.
Okay, which book do you wish you had written?
That's a hard call. I think the first book that Wilbur Smith ever wrote was called When the Lion Feeds. And that was an amazing book. It started off a career which has absolutely gone beyond the stars. And I would have loved to have written that book.
Cool. Not so bad because Wilbur Smith's doing pretty good out of it, I think. Okay, what is your favourite writing author moment so far?
My favourite author writing moment?
Yes, either writing or as an author. You know, what was the moment that you were just your favourite so far?
I think when the first time I actually held a book in my hand, which was a book between two covers and had my name on it, I think that was probably the best time, the most exciting time.
It really is. I totally agree. One of my favourite moments too. One thing you wish you'd been told about being a writer?
that there are a lot of con artists out there all waiting for your money.
Yeah. That would have been good advice.
Yeah, that would have saved you a lot of ran, I guess.
I think if somebody told me what I was in for, probably I would have approached the whole thing from a totally different viewpoint, for a different direction.
Okay, great. So that's the end of the lightning round. That's all we've got.
Yay!
That was amazing. I've loved talking to you guys.
We've loved talking to you. Ian, what a fascinating, I mean, I really was listening to the beginning, fascinating hearing about South African history. I had no idea of the experiences. And I love the idea that you've set it in Rhodesia so that you can sort of see this whole tapestry of story, but through that one place. I think it's going to be a really interesting book to read.
Yeah.
Give me your address and I'll send you copies of the book.
Oh, we'd love that. And you know what? Where can people get it, Ian, if people do want to get it themselves?
Well, it's on Amazon and it's on CreateSpace or Amazon.
We'll put it in our show notes. And you've got 3,000 copies that you've got, right?
I'm down to about 2,500 copies now because I have actually been selling them. But when I say selling them, I've been getting them out there and a lot of them have been sold. A lot of them are still sitting on shelves in bookstores, but they're a very, very small number of bookstores have actually taken them. But I've also been able to sort of sell them, you know, one off here, one off there. People said, guys, you know, I'd love to have a copy of your book. And I said, I've sold them a copy, and so it goes. But there are, at this point in time, I have roughly 2,500 books, which would love to find a home and would love to excite 2,500 people.
Yes, let's do it. Come on, people, call them up.
If you can find those people, I'd be delighted to be introduced to them.
We'll do what we can. We've got a pretty broad reach. You just never know who's listening, who's dying to have it. We have to admit that, like, Suzanne and I read your first chapter that's available on Amazon, and you are a great writer, and I think the richness of the story and the historical aspects really lends itself to being a really high-quality book. So I hope people will go check it out.
Yeah. I just want to thank you for joining us, Ian.
Well, it's been an absolute privilege, and it really has. It's been lovely talking to you, KJ, and you. It's been an experience which I've been interviewed before by a couple of radio stations, but this sort of just got a special edge to it. Thank you. I really, really appreciate it. I feel quite privileged.
Oh, you're so welcome, and we're so glad about everything that you've shared. Next week on the program, we have Kelly Schaefer, so stay tuned and join us next week to hear her interview as well. Thanks very much for joining us.
You can find our show notes and more information about our podcast at blondieandbrit.com. That's BLONDIEANDBRIT.com.